Hello, folks. Welcome to this week's episode of Coastal Catch-Ups. Today, I speak with Heidi McIlvenny, who is doing a PhD in seagrass. And I hear all about the benefits of having seagrass around our coastline in Northern Ireland, the threats that they face, and what can be done to help restore the habitats. So I learned a lot about seagrass today, and I hope you do too. We also touch on some other organisations that Heidi is involved in, which is all about connecting people with our coastlines in terms of it could be their work or it could be their hobbies, and they just wanted to get involved and connected, basically. So I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll catch you soon.
It's all about Marie and the coastal sea, aquatic life. Everything in between. So sit on down, hey, and take a seat. Coastal Catch-Ups with Sam P.
Heidi, thank you very much for coming on to Coastal Catch-Ups. Could we start by getting a bit about yourself and your relationship with the coastline?
I have kind of always been obsessed with the ocean. A lot of people can pinpoint that moment where, you know, something sparked their passion for whatever it might be. But for me, it's just always been there. My dad taught me to swim when I was really young and then threw me into the ocean. And, you know, every summer I was up in Benone bodyboarding. Anytime we went on a family holiday, it was an opportunity to snorkel like in a new place. And then I was lucky to learn to dive when I was 14. And then I progressed like through all the different PADI training courses through my teens. And then when I was 21 or something, got my PADI dive master. So I've been able to, you know, experience all these cool places like diving with reef sharks and whale sharks and like beautiful coral reefs. And then over the last year, I have done some diving for the first time in Northern Ireland, which is a much different experience. Like, no warm, clear waters here. It's cold. I learned to use a dry suit, was diving on some wrecks. But over the last few years, I've really fallen in love with the seas around the UK and Northern Ireland. And for so long, I thought, if I want to be a marine biologist, I have to go live somewhere else. And that's just not the case, but we're not exposed to the opportunities that exist here. So I'm lucky that I've been able to come home and do what I love. And even in the last few years, you know, my focus has really been on the coast rather than more offshore where all those big charismatic species are, because the coastline is, it's a place that's, you know, quite severely impacted by human activities in a negative way, but it's also the first place where you can take people to experience the sea, whether you know you're walking your dog on the beach or you go for a dip or even decide to go snorkeling. So it's so close to us that it's also that usually the first place where we can have our first experience of the sea.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think like the coast is where it all happens when people merge. Well, it's just members of the public or with you know, industries. Like, it's all happens on the coast, like ports and harbors, or like you say, just going for a walk on the beach, and that's where it all happens on the coast. So you were got your dive master at 21, and then you mentioned about coming back in Northern Ireland to dive. Whereabouts in Northern Ireland were you diving? It sounds like, was it Portaferry, Verrex, or is it elsewhere?
It was in Strangford Lough. I can't remember the name of the wreck. It was fairly deep because that was part of the training that I had to do.
Okay.
Are you familiar with it, the name of the wreck?
I know there's a wreck in Ringhattie.
Ringhattie, yes, that's the one.
Yeah. And I know my friend Catherine, who I work with, her dad runs DV Diving.
I did it with DV Diving.
DV Diving, so we're going to give them a shout out here.
Yes, absolutely. They did great training. It was because for part of my PhD research, I obviously have to dive here, but it required using Like having two tanks and a full face mask for comms. So all that specialty diving, they did the training for me and they were brilliant.
And then I think from Ring Hatty, you can launch it the way there's a like a stone key. You can walk out from there. Yeah, I don't dive, so
Huge
I didn't.
starfish.
Starfish.
Yeah, they're massive down there.
I think the UK, you mentioned about the stereotype of marine biologists and marine scientists working in nice crystal clear waters and coral reefs. And the reality is that, well, the UK has its in its own right beautiful waters. Like if you some of the photos I see people put up of the seaweeds, the red and green seaweeds, it's just incredible. And like the North Coast, I think particularly Strangford Lochs, the visibility isn't great, but like North Coast, the water up there is just incredibly clear.
Around the kelp forests that are along the north coast. I haven't been myself, but I've seen images and it's absolutely stunning. But yeah, our lochs do tend to be a little muddier usually, which makes the visibility worse.
So that was your diving experience, and then in terms of what's keeping you busy these days, what's going on?
So about a year ago, I started a PhD at Queen's University in Belfast. And I'd always kind of wanted to do a PhD, but was never sure, when was the right time, or I wanted to make sure it was a project I was really interested in. So it has been quite a few years since I did my master's and I've been working in the NGO sector. But this opportunity came up to really be able to shape my own research as opposed to having one already designed. And I was able to then focus it in around seagrass habitats here in Northern Ireland, which is quite timely given that they're kind of quite high priority in terms of policy and thinking about our climate mitigation strategies. It means that there's a lot of funding going into the research area, so felt like a good time to make the leap and go back to be a student.
Nice. So you came up with your own topic on seagrass then, and what in particular are you looking at?
There's a few different chapters that are all quite different from each other. But a significant bulk of it is focused on the carbon sequestration potential of seagrass. So maybe just explain a bit about seagrass in case people haven't heard of it before. It literally looks like the grass that you have in your garden, your lawn, at least for the two species that we have here in Northern Ireland. It's found in quite shallow waters. So we have an intertidal species, Zostra noltii, which you'll find in the intertidal zone, meaning that it can survive being completely exposed when the tide's fully out or fully submerged when the tide's in. And then a little further down the shore, you have Zostra marina, which is our subtidal species that tends to be a bit bigger, thicker, longer leaves, looks prettier in photographs. But both are really important habitats for supporting other wildlife. They create food and home and a 3D structure for invertebrates and little anemones, and they act as nursery grounds for small fish species, even ones that, will leave the nursery ground and go out and are important for our commercial fisheries. So that's kind of my focus habitat. And along with all those other ecosystem services, they're now being prioritized because of their carbon sequestration potential, which essentially means that they have the ability to lock away carbon for a very long time. So one of my questions is how much organic carbon is actually stored in the sediment below the habitat. And that's where they store all the carbon. So those sediments, usually muddy or sandy, can be really deep, quite a few meters. So that means that there's, hundreds, thousands, maybe even million years worth of accumulation of sediment. So it's a long time that that carbon's been locked away, and it means that it hasn't, re-entered the water column or potentially re-entered the atmosphere. So what are thinking, okay, it's really important that we make sure that that carbon stays locked away, firstly. Secondly, that our habitats can continue to lock away even more carbon. And thirdly, because we know we've lost a lot of our seagrass habitats in the past, how can we potentially restore them so that we can kind of renew or revitalize this ecosystem service that they provide. Hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you mentioned about habitats and the two types of species, so there's one intertidal and one subtidal, basically. In my mind, we're talking about strangford loch. I'm going to go back to strangford loch. Brent geese come in, they rely, is that the eelgrass that
Yes.
is the intertidal species? So it's so important for wintering birds, and I'm sure other birds that visit the shores of Northern Ireland. The subtidal stuff, is this is just a question that popped into my head. Is it seasonal? Is the grass seasonal? So wintertime you can't really see it, in summertime you can see it. Is that, or am I making that up?
And for the intertidal, so yeah, some people call it eelgrass or some people call it dwarf eelgrass. So we don't have a full picture of the dynamics because we don't have year-long monitoring of these habitats. In most places, we definitely don't have it in Northern Ireland, but generally speaking, its growing period is during the summer. And it'll peak towards the end of the summer. And then, like you said, the Brent geese arrive and it's a key food source for them. So they eat all most of it. And when you go out in the winter or towards the end of the winter, it's pretty much all gone. There'll only be a few bits left, but it'll regrow each year. The subtidal stuff, I'm not entirely sure. It obviously doesn't get fed on by birds like the Brent geese. So it's likely to be less, like have less of those dynamic changes, but again, nobody's monitoring it. You had a person on the podcast before called Dr. Rachel Miller. I know that she's part of the dive team looking at the seagrass regrowth for an eco mooring in Strangford Loch. And they actually dived in March, which is unusual because sometimes it's usually the summer period. So that'll be really exciting to get the results of her diving over the next few years to see what it actually looks like at other times of year to help us, figure out what's going on.
Keep putting the dry suit on, Rachel. Keep.
Yes. I'm hoping she's going to help me in the summertime with some of my diving. That I need to do for my research. But the other thing to think about in terms of seasonal dynamics is the carbon as well. So I will be taking carbon sediment cores on the intertidal beds once per season, because the majority of the data that's out there at the moment is taken from cores only during the summer when the seagrass is at its most lush. But it's important to understand, especially for that top layer of sediment that's most vulnerable to being remineralized, how is that actually changing or accumulating during the winter whenever there isn't as much canopy to protect it, or there's also increasing like stormier weather and stuff.
So there could potentially be a slight decrease after the grass has been removed. And
Yeah,
yeah,
potentially.
carbon storage, in terms of, is it the sediment? So in my mind, there's two things. So carbon can be stored in the actual grass itself, but I think it's called biomass storage. And then there's just a sediment that maybe flows through the grass beds and then settles in. Is it So it's more of a case of sediment settling in the beds you're interested in, is that right?
Yeah, so this is where our blue carbon habitats, like our seagrasses, also our salt marshes and mangroves, but we don't have those here. They're tropical water. So salt marsh and seagrasses here mainly. They're different in terms of their carbon sequestration potential compared to terrestrial habitats, mainly because of what you've said there. The majority of the organic carbon is locked away in the sediment below the habitat as opposed to in the living material itself. Whereas if you look at trees, it's mostly stored in, the trunks and the leaves. And then there's different risks that come with that, wildfires increasing or just like the removal of tree species, you're get remo sort of releasing that carbon, whereas you don't have that kind of risk in the sea. However, you can still have physical disturbance or destruction of a habitat that can release the organic carbon from the sediment itself.
So, is it fair to say that blue carbon ecosystems can store more than terrestrial ecosystems?
As a general sweeping question, that seems to be true. Seagrass and salt marshes and mangroves vary a lot in terms of even between different species of themselves. So seagrass habitats, there's lots of different species. I've mentioned the two that are here in Northern Ireland. There's a species called Posidonia oceanica. That might not be how you actually pronounce it. But it can be found in the Mediterranean, and it's much, much bigger. So like, the leaves are a couple of meters, and it's most of the estimates think that it's storing significantly more carbon than our much smaller species. And that would make sense, because the water flow is going to be reduced a lot more, encouraging more particles to kind of accumulate on the seabed. The other important difference, though, between blue carbon habitats and terrestrial carbon habitats is that the sediment in the ocean is anoxic. So you essentially have really low oxygen conditions to no oxygen within the sediment. That prevents bacteria from breaking down the organic carbon. So that's why it actually stays there. Whereas if you look at soil on land, there's lots of microbial activity that do different things, that one of which is breaking down organic matter. So therefore it's not locked away for long periods of time.
So seagrass is vital for carbon storage. You mentioned about we have lost a lot of our seagrass beds. What has happened and what are the threats to seagrass at the minute?
So a paper came out a couple of years ago, so it's still quite recent, that specifically looked at seagrass loss in the UK. And it's very hard to kind of get an estimate of that because we don't have good historical records. So we don't really have maps saying seagrass existed here to this extent during this period of time. But those records do exist in some places. So they estimated very conservatively that we've lost around 40% of our seagrass habitats. But they did put in that paper that, they're confident in that estimate, but it could be as high as 92%. So a huge amount, basically, of this habitat has disappeared from our coastlines. Important to note that that paper didn't have data from Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland tends to be quite data poor, especially for our marine kind of habitats. The key drivers of seagrass loss, there's kind of three main ones. There's physical disturbance, so literally kind of tearing the seagrass up out of the sediment. That can happen from boats anchoring and mooring on top of a seagrass bed, or for the intertidal beds. Sometimes you'll see like tractor marks, maybe for farmers going to their agriculture areas, go through a seagrass bed, which isn't good. The second is a disease, it was called wasting disease. It mainly affected seagrass beds in the 1930s. There isn't, it's present in some beds now, but it hasn't completely sort of wiped out populations since then. And then the last one is water quality. So increased inputs of nutrients can have quite significant negative impacts on beds, and that is likely to be impacting the beds here around Northern Ireland. I can't say that definitively because no one's actually done the research, but it's one of my chapters in my PhD that I want to look at the condition of the beds and try and relate that to potential drivers or pressures around the bed.
Okay, so we have physical disturbance between chains running across the seabed or tractor tires, which is a good point. If you think about like farmers accessing oyster beds and stuff like that, I'm sure, I think they use the big tractors with really wide wheels to stop them sinking. So you can imagine the impact of that happening every time. Then we have disease, and then we have water quality. What sort of factors in the water quality would affect seagrass? Is it like temperature, pH, that sort of stuff, or is it more pollutants with from contaminants from industry or sewage or any other sources.
It's mostly to do with the level of nutrients in the water, which can be a result of like urban runoff, agricultural runoff, wastewater discharge. So your usual kind of culprits, but it just depends where the seagrass bed is situated. Like, is it closer to a town or a city, or is it, completely surrounded by farmland? Will depend on what the biggest pressure is.
In terms of mitigating the impact then of seagrass, we mentioned about the likes of eco-moorings. How important is that for the habitats going forward?
Because we know that we don't have as much seagrass as we used to, our first priority has to be protecting what we have. And if you can alleviate physical disturbances, then we should be doing that pretty quickly. Eco moorings are proven technology. They've been rolled out in other parts of the world. It's great now that Northern Ireland has a trial, so they've installed two different ones, trying to see which one, works out the best. But I think it is important that we do that pretty swiftly because it well there I mean people have been mooring their boats in some areas for years and years and years, so the scarring that will be left by the chain will be quite significant. But seagrass is very good at recovering, so as soon as you lift that chain off the ground, it's likely that it will grow back and fill in those patches, which is good. And it doesn't stop people from using their boats in those areas. You can have happy, healthy seagrass and happy, healthy people. It doesn't have to be one or the other, which is good. But because so that's kind of what's known as passive restoration. So take away the pressure and it'll recover itself. But because seagrass's habitats are in such sort of poor condition and in such limited extent now, people have decided that active restoration is actually what's needed, where you're literally planting either seagrass seeds or taking little plugs of the plant and putting it in a new place to try and re-establish it in new areas. We haven't trialed anything like that in Northern Ireland yet, but hopefully that's something we can do. But the question is, where do you do it? Where does it make sense historically, but also where does it make sense to do that given we have changing climatic conditions? Is it going to survive as we get more rainfall or we get warmer sea temperatures or more storms? Also, they so especially for like our intertidal habitats, as sea levels rise, will they be able to keep up with and move further up the shore so that they still get the levels of exposure and submersion that they need? Or are they trapped because we've built like hard sea defenses in some places, so there's actually nowhere for them to move back to? That's actually particularly important for salt marshes, of which we have very, very little, because people build houses and infrastructure and farm pretty much right up to the coastline. So there's some tough decisions there about, well, what's the best use for this land? What can we give back to nature and what do we need to sort of stand strong on? If that makes sense.
Yeah, like that's one of the key. I suppose this is coming back to like the whole general theme of this podcast about sustainable use. So you mentioned about passive restoration with eco-moorings, which would allow a habitat to exist in alongside human activity, recreation, which is absolutely would be great. The in terms of you're describing coastal squeeze there, isn't that right? About the habitats not being able to migrate back. Yeah, if someone puts in a hard flood wall, it could wipe out a habitat if there's nowhere for it to go when the sea level rises. And then I suppose you could bring in, that's when people look at alternatives such as soft engineering, whereas or that's when maybe human settlements or properties maybe might be at risk. And it's difficult. It's really difficult when human properties and buildings get involved, because I think generally they come off top. I don't know if that's if you agree.
I think it's fair to say that the environment and nature has not been top of the priority list politically for the last, like, well, probably forever in Northern Ireland. And ultimately, these decisions are political. They're not only like based on pure science. So much goes into the decision making. But it's a good thing that Northern Ireland now has a Climate Change Act. And in that act, there's a line about having to consider nature-based projects or nature-based solutions. And that's the things we've been talking about in terms of soft engineering, managed realignment, and restoration projects like eco moorings or actively planting seagrass. So there's a legislative driver to do these things now. So hopefully we can start to make some better decisions, because it's not just, oh, if we get rid of the salt marsh and build a wall, we lose so much more than our salt marsh, because it's more than just like a species in itself. It is a habitat that supports so much other nature. And we have to take that into account. Plus, it's ultimately, over the long term, it's usually a better choice economically to make these decisions that support nature and nature's recovery, even though they sometimes could be more difficult decisions to make in the short term.
So in the future, could we put out an early call for volunteers now that would go out on mud flats and plant little seedlings of seagrass? Is this
That would
is
be
it too
might be a bit premature,
premature?
but watch this space. I think the first thing we need to do is we need to know exactly where our seagrass habitats are, what condition they're in, and why they're in that condition. And then that'll give us an idea of, okay, where in terms like what where makes the most sense to do some active restoration. But I am 100% in favor of actively trying to bring nature back in all of its forms on land and at sea, because we're so nature poor, and it's sad. And sometimes people think environmental policies are quite radical, and that blows my mind, because I think a world without nature is radical. How could you possibly want that as a preference? So yes, listeners, keep an eye out for future restoration projects, because all the ones that I've visited and read about across the UK, and they've been taking place in America and Australia as well, they do require a lot of volunteer support. This is not something that could be done by like one weird little scientist at a university. It takes everybody, because you have to collect, millions of seeds, and then you kind of have them over the winter, and then you have to replant them in these little Hessian bags full of sand. So if you're willing to get out and help with that, that would be fantastic.
Just let me know, Heidi. I'll put the call out whenever it's in place. No, that's great. And it's been great to hear about your knowledge of seagrass and the PhD you're doing. Wish you all the best with the rest of the research. In terms of other organizations you're involved with, then Heidi, in your if you have any spare time after doing all this research, but any other organizations you're involved with?
Yes, so I'm a member of the Irish Ocean Literacy Network, and I'd really encourage everybody to check out their website. You literally just Google Irish Ocean Literacy Network. They are a network of different organizations from across the island of Ireland. They span from conservation organizations to like established universities and the likes of the Marine Institute and AFBE. And different industries like aquaculture, fisheries, all sorts of things. And it's about bringing people together so that we can understand our impact on the ocean and the ocean's impact on us, and encourage dialogue. So that network is going through a bit of a transition period, but in the future, there will be lots of opportunities to network with these organizations. There'll be training opportunities and events. And you can join as an individual or as a representative of your organization. I'd also like to shout out another project that's ongoing in Carlingford Lough, if you're in and around the area. It's called Shifting Tides, and it's a mixture of citizen science around the it's like a coastal based project. So some of it is about the seagrass there, but it's mixed with a lot of work with artists, so different ways of expressing and interacting, and yeah, how you feel about nature, things like that. So you can give that a Google as well and sign up to their events. They have a couple on now, and they'll have lots more on in the summer.
And are these like exhibitions, or are these like workshops people can turn up in? Is it hands-on work? What sort of?
It's a mix. So sometimes there's speakers, sometimes it's getting out hands-on doing the science stuff. Sometimes it's workshops with the artists, or it could be an ex I, well, further towards the end of the project, I suspect there'll be an exhibition.
Very good. The ocean literacy stuff, I imagine that's important. You're bringing a lot of different organizations that maybe focus on a particular aspect. For example, yourself with seagrass, and then bringing it in with maybe someone, I don't know, another particular topic. And it's important for that dialogue between all the different networks. Is that kind of the aim of that?
Yeah, the aim is to try and connect everyone up so that we can all kind of move together more strategically. And yes, there are areas where not where maybe some organizations or industries come into attention, but under there's sort of 10 ocean literacy principles. It's a United Nations decade concept that you can read about. And fundamentally, whether you are playing in the sea or working in the sea, it's about understanding that connection and how you treat the ocean and how the ocean can treat you back, kind of. And it encompasses all sorts of things between knowledge production, which is quite scientific, through to emotions and spiritual connection, as well as like activism or recreation. So that's why everybody's welcome, and hopefully everybody gets something out of the network that benefits them. And the sort of high level vision of the network is to have an ocean literate society, which can sound a bit highfalutin, but to me it's really important because it goes back to the fact that we are an island community, and sometimes I think we forget that. You know, we're not very big. In Northern Ireland, you're something like never more than 35 miles from the sea. Like, we're so connected. And even if you look at our river systems, you know, if you look at a map and you remove all the land and just have the rivers, you can tell exactly where, you know, the big populations are and the shape of our coastline. It's all there. So I think we need to reignite that a bit more, reconnect with our island heritage.
And I think that would have a massive impact when even just planting little seeds of knowledge, and maybe someone's not aware of, I don't know, seagrass beds, or and it's just making everyone aware of what's happening, and then how our actions can, the likes of that river network in Northern Ireland, you could, like, for example, litter entering storm drains from a street in Belfast and then ending up in Belfast Lough and et cetera. You know, it's how it's all interconnected and making people just aware of it. Is that right? Yeah.
Exactly. And just because you've given me that example, a few weeks ago, I was in Belfast city centre, walking back from having a dinner out. It was like, you know, 10 o'clock, so people are out and about and it's quite lively. And I see someone got handed like a pamphlet to advertise something, and they clearly didn't want it. So they put it in the storm drain as if that was a bin. And that just blew my mind. But it's because not everyone realizes that that's actually not just going to, I don't know where they think it's going, to be honest, but it's ending up in the lock.
And it's probably the same person who'll be walking at Helen's Bay or something and be like, oh, you know, this is, look
This
at
is
all
terrible.
this beach. Yeah, it's all connected at the end of the day. And yeah, so I think those two organizations sound like, yeah, it's, they're doing a great thing by allowing people to connect with our coastline. And like you say, the island, I think it's something to be proud of and reignited, I should say. And I think, yeah.
Yeah, and it's exactly what you're doing with this podcast here. You decided you wanted to learn from people who do so many different things, like live, work, and play differently around the coastline. And then you've been really generous in making it a podcast so that we can all like learn and experience that along with you. So I think this is really brilliant.
Yeah, no, I've really enjoyed this journey because you hear about people that use it for work or for play and all the different ways it helps people, and it could be mental health, it could be physical exercise, it could be actually helping the environment, and it's the list is just endless, and hopefully it'll continue to go. And yeah, if you've any recommendations of people that could come on, please let me know.
There's loads. You've already interviewed a few of my friends and colleagues who are brilliant, but that's also something that really excites me. Like, there's a generation of people who are like early career that I've had, been able to work with, and I think, oh, you're brilliant, and I hope you stay in this sector, like, because you're going to do great things and really make big changes. So there's lots of good people that you can talk to. I'll certainly recommend a few.
You maybe thought you would escape this question, but the TED talk you did recently.
Yes, the TED Talk.
Now, well, tell me how you got involved in that and where people can watch it.
So the TED Talk is on YouTube. You can search my name if you so wish to watch it. It is about blue carbon habitats, and more widely about, bringing nature back is a way for us to strengthen our defense against the worst impacts of climate change. It was held in Stormont, so the Centre for Democracy organised it as a TEDx Stormont event, and the theme was Restore. So there's a huge variety of talks that I'd recommend you listen to. There's some around mental health, there's some around music. John Martin, head of advocacy and campaigning at RSPB, did one on nature recovery also, which is excellent. So because I wanted to talk specifically about ocean restoration, I pitched that as a talk and they accepted me as a speaker. And it was a really interesting experience because the delivery of a TED talk is very different from a scientific presentation, a business pitch, or even delivering training. You really have to think differently about how you deliver it. So I learned a lot doing that process.
Yeah, I watched it last week and you smashed it. I think you came across like very smooth, just the concepts you delivered in a very simple and way that people can easily understand. And yeah, just thought it was very smooth. Yeah. So if anyone wants to find out more about blue carbon, you can head over and watch that YouTube video of your TED Talk. Hope you don't mind me plugging that. But I thought
No.
people will be interested to hear.
Thank you very much. And if anyone has the opportunity to do a TED talk, I would highly recommend it. I think it's made a big difference to how I communicate ideas. And it was very kind of you to say there that I was able to talk about the concepts in a way that was quite simple because you're so used to talking to people in your field, whereas the audience on the day was so varied and I didn't know what people didn't know. So trying to think about how you get people to care, get people to listen, get people to understand, get people to feel is important and something maybe we don't spend a lot of time usually thinking about.
Yeah, no, certainly came across that. You definitely ticked all those boxes, so yeah, it was awesome. Heidi, just want to say thank you very much for coming on a Friday afternoon. You could probably be doing other things, but thank you for coming on to Coastal Catch-Ups.
No problem at all. I was delighted that you had an interest in seagrass, and I'm always happy to talk a bit about it.
Yeah, no, an opportunity to pick a expert's brain. Can't turn that down. So no, it was awesome, and I'm sure everyone listening has found it interesting. So thank you for your time, and I'll catch you soon.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Heidi and learned a lot about seagrass habitats. For me, as you know, you've probably found trend in what I'm interested in and allowing these habitats spaces to exist alongside humans without any disturbance. And then you also have the active restoration with seagrass, which doesn't currently happen in Northern Ireland, but perhaps in the very near future, there'll be a call for volunteers to go out and plant seagrass. So here's your warning, and keep an eye out for more of that. Also really enjoyed the learning about ocean literacy and connecting people to our coastline, which is very, very important to make people aware of what happens in our coastline under the low water mark. Or we used the example of dropping litter in a street in Belfast, and it could be ended up in Belfast Lough. And that might sound stupid to you, but I'm sure if you look at the lagging on a wet day, you'd probably be disgusted. So it's just how it's all connected, our behaviour on land and how it impacts our coastline. If you've enjoyed the episode today, leave a review and share it with someone who you think might find it interesting. I'm sure some budding marine biologists or someone who just is a general user of our coastline around Northern Ireland who might find this interesting. Just a quick one on my upcoming collaboration with Strangford Lough Boat Tours. We have organised an eco tour of the Lough starting in April and running into May. So the idea is, I'll be your tour guide round Strangford Lough and point out various habitats, features, and if we're lucky, some species around Lough. Andy, who runs Strangford Lough Boat Tours, is a registered with the WISE scheme, and basically this means he's a responsible tour operator, and will basically the objective is not to have any impact on wildlife during a tour. So we won't be chasing any dolphins around. It'll purely be if we spot anything, we'll observe from a distance and take it all in and let the animals control the encounter. Otherwise, it should be good crack, a good day out in the sea, and hopefully we get the weather for it. So if you're keen, I'll pop the link below. And apart from that, I hope you have a good week, and I'll catch you soon.